Well, Australians, we constantly remind ourselves, love our sporting heroes. And there are a few more revered than our champion swimmers, taking on the world, carting home world records and gold medals. I bet you could name at least half a dozen swimming stars before I finish the next sentence. In the early 1970s, one of those stars was Brad Cooper, described by Australia's most successful swimming coach, Don Talbot, as the most talented swimmer he ever trained. In 1972, aged just 18, Brad Cooper achieved his manifest destiny with Olympic gold at the Munich Games. But nothing about his winning race, or indeed the games themselves, went entirely to script. All is revealed in a new book from Brad Cooper called The Finest Gold. Brad, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you very much, Hugh.
Let's get right into 1972. You've gone to the Olympic Games. You've swum in your pet event. What happened?
Well, I touched very close to the winner, Rick DeMott, an American. There was 100th of a second that decided that distance. And it was the first Olympics to have that that tightness of timing. At all previous Olympics, 1/10 would have separated us. And that was fine. I mean, silver was great too. But then over the next 24 hours, another technology that had been introduced at those Olympics surfaced. That was drug testing. And Rick was an asthmatic, and he had exceeded the allowance for ephedrine that was basically based on a prescription norm, and he was a fair bit over that. So he lost the medal, and I got it.
How did you feel about that?
I felt pretty good, actually, because, I mean, all I've ever aspired to is compete in the rules. And it was explained to me that those rules, you know, were fair in that Rick DeMott, that is, you know, was a lot over the prescription norm. So obviously he'd exceeded the amount that he should have taken for the prescription. I was reported as being a little bit apprehensive about it by a journalist, but I was sort of verbal there, and because that journalist sort of made me feel as if I shouldn't be accepting it, and used terms like, you know, or phrases like the poor kid was disqualified for taking his medicine, you know. So I was fairly guarded in my response, and so he interpreted that as you know, me not wanting it, which was, you know, a long way from the truth.
And with the perspective of, 40-plus years since then, was it your sense that the man that you beat because he was disqualified had simply, you know, made an honest error with some asthma medication, or do you think there was doping involved deliberately?
I don't think in any sense it was deliberate doping. I think it was a very nervous kid. He was even younger than I was. I'd just turned 18. He was still 16. And he was incredibly nervous. And I think as an insurance policy, he took a little bit more than he should have. I mean, I've never thought anything different than that. It was just a nervous kid, you know, not really appreciating what he was doing. He thought he was taking extra medicine to make sure that he didn't have a recurrence of some, you know, wheezing problem. And I think that about sums it up.
So 1972, as history remembers it, is the Games when, of course, there was a terrorist attack, Palestinian terrorists under the Black September group seized members of the Israeli team. I think it was 11 members of the Israeli team, coaches and athletes, and killed them. What was your awareness of that as that unfolded?
Very little, actually. We were a lot of that information was filtered, not just from us as team members, but from the public, as German police tried to control a situation that was, you know, desperately out of control. And so you can imagine we were insulated, and we had just finished our swimming. We were in high spirits, basically, but we were only very slowly did it dawn on us that something catastrophic had happened. And it was basically everything that happened. It was in the past tense by the time we were apprised of the whole story.
So what was it like when you got home? You've got a newly minted Olympic gold medal. It's the thing you've been working towards since you were a small child, really. Did you get a sort of a ticker tape welcome back home? Was it a big deal? How did you feel in your moment of glory?
Yeah, we got a couple of welcome homes, ticker tape, as you say. One in Sydney, I think another one in Brisbane. And then a suburb where I lived in Brisbane when I was about 11 or 12 provided one too, and that was very touching. It was just fine. The only problem was that I really didn't know what I was going to do, because I knew that the the pace of world records was moving so fast, I knew that I wouldn't be around to defend that title at the next Olympics. So it was just a matter of should I keep swimming? Because I had actually abandoned a lot of my schooling. I truanted and things like that, because that was the only way I knew to cope, to recover between training sessions. So I was really not, I'd sort of felt out of the loop, actually. So I just kept swimming and deferred whatever I thought was going to be my educational future and kept deferring. Ultimately, it'd be another 7 or 8 years before I went back and did my HSC. So I was in limbo, but a happy limbo, because it is quite a good life for being an elite athlete. I just looked at a day at a time, actually, after that.
It's funny, because in your book you refer to it as your gold medal coming after a decade of waterlogged subservience. That doesn't sound like a glamorous life.
In effect, that is mostly true, because what happens when you're a swimmer, you begin training, formal training that is, quite early in life, possibly a lot earlier than other sports, where by the age of 7 or 8, you're sort of locked into a rigid attendance schedule. Say you're 7, you might be going once a week, 8, you might be going twice a week. It's not like other sports where you can fiddle around with a few sports and be casual in your attendance, and suddenly at 13 discover what you're good at and possibly go to the Olympics several years later. You just can't do that with swimming. So you do get this history that you are very deferential, reflexively deferential almost, and you don't really learn to be a great self-advocate for a long time.
It's funny, because you describe your relationship with Don Talbot, this famously successful swimming coach. He is said, even in the Hall of Fame reference to him in the Sports Australia Hall of Fame, as having been a feared disciplinarian. What is it like as a child dealing with a grown man who is fearful in his discipline?
Yeah, his reputation preceded him. And when I went down to began training with him at 15, and honestly, to meet someone like that in the flesh for the first time, it is quite an intimidating experience, because there was a combativeness around it. It wasn't just a discipline. Coaches can be disciplinarian, but he was also combative with it. And he had a look to his face that, he had these two clear lines on his forehead. Most people have 3 or 4, but he had 2, and one of them seemed to say my way, and the other one, which converged on it, said the highway. Just for a flash, when I first met him, I had the feeling, how long has it been on the outside, this guy? Because he's such a tough-looking man, and he acted tough as well.
Did he bring out the best in you?
No, not really, I don't think. You see, I wasn't a typical trainer. I mean, I was surrounded at Auburn Pool, where that was his headquarters, by incredibly tough, swimmers who had been training with him for years and years, and they knew what to expect. And I just never had that level of energy, because I'd come from a system in Brisbane where we only did half that number of kilometres. Like, we only did 4 or 5, and he was doing 8 and 9 and 10. And one night, I was kept in until about 8:30 at night, and I'd been in there since 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I did about 15Ks because I had, committed some infringement, and I was kept back. It was always hard, and I was always failing. And often I was, because of that failure, I was often kicked over to what we call the shame lanes. In other words, in 1 minute you're swimming with elite internationals, then you're kicked over 3 lanes to the side, and you're swimming with 12 and 13-year-olds. So, and then once you're over there, he didn't let you back in the top lane for another 48 hours just to make sure that, you don't stuff around with Donnie and come swanning straight back. So I struggled every week that I was under Don.
Tell us about your mum and dad.
Well, they divorced when I was about 12, and there was already this schism in our family where Dad and I were the swimmers. We loved swimming, and my brothers really didn't like it that much, and they hadn't had as much success. And then when my parents split up, they went with Mum, great, more parties, no swimming, and I went with Dad. And so we kept swimming. But he, after the divorce, he went a little bit funny. He quit his job, which wasn't a wise thing to do. And then he sort of started moving around a lot in temporary accommodation, like boarding houses, sleep outs. And we averaged, one every couple of months for a couple of years there, and that was between Brisbane and Sydney and the outer suburbs of Brisbane. That was very difficult for those couple of years. I think we moved 13 times until we settled at this place in Edmundston Street, South Brisbane. And then 9 months later, that's when I went down and trained with Talbot.
Quite a story, isn't it? How do you handle your charge? You're a swimming coach now. Do you make yourself the fearful disciplinarian, or what do you take from your own experience?
in my first couple of years of coaching, I did make the mistake of trying to emulate Don Talbot, but I'm such a different person that it didn't work, and I just got really tore myself apart, and and even my health didn't feel all that flash. So I thought, no, this is not me. Either I quit coaching, or I become another person, you know. And in fact, swimmers, elite swimmers, are often counselled not to coach, because one thing that happens, you know, parents of young kids sort of expect a bit more out of you because you obviously have the secret. You did it, you know. And so, therefore, with those expectations, it can be much higher to start with, which is, you know, not good for the old pressure barometer.
You name as your year that made you, not the year in which you won the Olympic gold medal. What was your year?
Well, I'll give that 1971, because something that happened in that year, I would never have been good enough at freestyle, which is the stroke that I won my Olympic gold medal. And I was primarily a backstroker. And in 1971, I was already good enough to have represented Australia in backstroke, but our standard was not that flashy backstroke. What happened, I was living with Don Talbot, with his family, so I just picked up this flashy brochure that was there. And it just happened to be from Mark Spitzer's coach, Doc Counselman, the famous Doc Counselman. And he was proposing this new sort of theory about how swimmers provided propulsion by their arms underwater. And it spoke about these sort of sweeps and these lift and drag forces, fairly complicated scientific stuff. And I was absorbed and fascinated. So I started experiments myself. And after another month or two, my freestyle was so good, I kept keeping up with that swimmer, Graham Windett, who just set a world record in the 800. And I started beating him. And from then on, I stayed ahead of him right till Munich. It was a revelation. It was just such serendipity. And that's why I think that was a year that made me, at least in terms of my swimming success.
Great story. Pick up the brochure. Try your luck. Brad Cooper, an absolute pleasure talking to you. Your song is Rod Stewart's Maggie May. Why this song?
Just because you seemed on the airwaves so much around that time that I made that improvement. And it's an extremely happy song, and it was the start of summer. It sounded like a summery song. And, of course, I think it's a fantastic pop tune. You know, pop. I don't think pop musicians get enough credit, but I recall that and I associate that with that improvement.
Well, congratulations again on your gold medal from 1972 and your book, newly released, Brad Cooper. The book is called The Finest Gold. And here is Rod Stewart with Maggie May. Thank you.
Thank you, Hugh.
Rod Stewart at the height of his powers, Maggie May there, the song chosen by my guest for the year that made me, Brad Cooper.